All right, so I'm going to be talking about the other formation channel for black hole binaries, this idea that, as far as I can tell, really first came around from Simon Portugis-Swart and Steve McMillan in around 2000, that in dense enough stellar environments, you can actually take single isolated black holes and bring them together close enough that you can actually dynamically form a binary in some fashion or another that will actually eventually merge in a Hubble time and potentially yield gravitational waves like GW150914. So when I talk about dense star clusters, I really talk about, there's really three different types of clusters that we usually think about when we're talking about this. There's open clusters, these sort of smaller, younger clusters that maybe have a few thousands, maybe tens of thousands of members. There's globular clusters, like M30 up here, which are these generally very large, very old clusters that are found in most galaxies. And then there's nuclear star clusters, galactic nuclei, the really big honking central star clusters in the centers of many observed galaxies. Now, for reasons that will become clear at the end, I'm mostly going to talk about globular clusters and nuclear star clusters for this talk, just because they are much more massive, and they generally have a lot more interesting dynamics going on that can really create some very interesting systems. So focusing on globular clusters for now, like I said, they're generally these very old, very massive star clusters. Most of the ones we see in our galaxy and under nearby galaxies are roughly about 12 giga-years old. We think they were formed early on in the evolution of, and star formation history of most galaxies. They're very massive, generally 10 to the 5 to 10 to the 6 stars, give or take, when they're born. And they're very, very compact. So the average radius for a cluster of this size is maybe a couple of parsecs. So you end up with stellar densities in the middle that are 10 to the 5 or maybe even 10 to the 6 stars per parsec cube, which is obviously well in excess of anything you would see anywhere near, say, the stellar neighborhood. Like I said, they're found in most galaxies. The Milky Way, for instance, has about 200 globular clusters in it, give or take. Some larger elliptical galaxies, like M87, have around 13,000 globular clusters. And it generally, as far as we can tell, seems to scale with the halo mass. So galaxies with larger dynamical masses have more globular clusters. So there's this idea. So, I mean, obviously, we see these things observationally, and it's kind of hard to work out, you know, at 12 giga-years, how do these things form. It's a lot easier to start off with a cartoon picture where you just consider a bunch of stars that are essentially in fixed orbits traveling around some sort of cluster, so sort of like what we've got here. And as these things travel through the cluster, there's really two timescales that are important to keep in mind. The first is obviously the orbital timescale. How long does it take a star to cross from one side of the cluster to the other? And the other is going to be, how long does it take for one of those orbits to slowly change its own configuration within the cluster, what we call the relaxation timescale. It's usually related to the dynamicals timescale by a factor of n over log n, so n being the number of stars. And as you start these things off and let them evolve, what you'll see is, as these stars basically interact with one another, and as they basically hyperbolically deflect off of one another, they can actually exchange energy and angular momentum, which causes them to sort of change their orbits on order of that relaxation timescale. And as that proceeds, eventually these clusters move towards a phase called core collapse, where you end up with a very dense, very central region in the center, where you can have these very high stellar densities. And the outer parts of the cluster sort of puff up in response to that. They sort of get bigger in order to conserve energy. Now, normally this would take on order of about 16 relaxation times if you're just looking at a system with only equal mass particles. So relaxation time for a cluster like this is maybe about 10 to the 9 times 10 to, or 10 to the 10 years. So obviously, 16 relaxation times is going to be in significant excess of a Hubble time. But if we look at something with an actual mass spectrum, if we look at, say, something with, say, 10 or 50 or 80 solar mass black holes in it, then you're going to have a second effect come into play, which is this idea of dynamical friction. So if I have a massive black hole traveling through essentially a sea of lighter stars, it's going to gravitationally pull those stars towards it and essentially build up a bulk behind the black hole as it's moving through the cluster. And in that process, it's going to cause this gravitational deceleration. And over time, that's going to cause these massive particles, the black holes, to segregate into the center of the cluster. So if I go back to this cartoonish picture, and now I ask, how long is this mass segregation going to take for things that we're actually interested in, like, say, 30 solar mass black holes, the answer is going to be something on the order of about 100 million years. It's actually the relaxation time times the average mass in the cluster over the mass I'm interested in. So usually you divide these by almost a factor of 100 for black holes. So at least for globular clusters, the old idea has been these systems are born in from a single giant molecular cloud that fragmented about 12 giga years ago. And then very rapidly, the most massive single stars went supernova, leaving behind a large population of black holes. Now then, mass segregation and dynamical friction jump into play, and they slowly bring these black holes right into the center, where the relaxation time, at least in the core, where these sort of dynamical interactions that can eventually form binaries, is much, much smaller than the half-mass relaxation time, the total relaxation time for the cluster. And as the evolution of these things progresses, you're slowly going to shoot out, essentially, these black holes from the cluster. They're just going to go flying out, some as single black holes, some as binary black holes, until you're eventually at the end left with maybe one or two black holes left in the cluster. Now, that's the story for somewhat smaller clusters that you might see, like lower mass globulars or open clusters. For some of the more massive stuff that we see, like larger globular clusters or galactic nuclei, we think you can actually still retain significant numbers of black holes up to the present day, especially for massive globular clusters. Some of the more recent simulations by Maggie Morsher have shown that you could potentially retain thousands of black holes up to the present day. So we start off with some initial binary fraction, usually much lower than open clusters. So we usually start off with 5 or 10% binaries. What we find in practice, which I'll get to in a minute, is that most of those actually don't, those are not the ones that eventually end up forming black hole binaries. Those are actually formed almost entirely by dynamics in globular clusters. Yeah, usually by either, it's not usually evaporation, it's usually like a binary singular encounter, something very chaotic, very resonant, that's actually going to just completely fling it out of the core. So I just take pretty much any example, any chance I can to show this movie. It's a little bit silly for this purposes, but still. The idea is once you have this, what I managed to get in the APJ letter called a dynamical mosh pit going on at the center of these clusters, you can actually start to have interactions that are rare and that are incredibly rare in a galaxy like the Milky Way, but very, very likely when you have high densities like in the center of these clusters. So you can actually get three single black holes come close enough to one another that they'll actually form a bound binary through what's called a three-body encounter. So you'll actually form a dynamically formed three-body binary. And then that binary itself is just going to wander throughout the center of the cluster, getting interactions with other isolated black holes and other stars, which are going to, over time, affect its orbit, its semi-major axis and eccentricity. So after seeing the nice cartoons that Chris Belchinsky put out for the evolution of the isolated field binaries, I felt compelled to try and come up with a nice, simple cartoon of my own. Failed completely in the simple side of things, but what this is showing is, at least for two GW150914 type systems, what kind of dynamical history would these things have, could these things have had in a dense star cluster? The thing is, these interactions are incredibly chaotic. Each one of these is usually a strong encounter. So like the binary exists, and then another black hole comes in. It either undergoes a strong resonant encounter that can change the orbital properties of the binary, or it can actually completely eject one of the members and replace it with the sort of interloping third black hole. So it's these sort of crazy, insane, chaotic encounters that just build up over time. And the more massive the cluster, the more of these encounters you actually build up before it manages to eject it out. So at least looking at this looks a little bit daunting. This is a very chaotic, very complicated procedure. You're not really going to be able to get anything tractable without doing large, complicated models. But there is one saving grace from this that I think makes this really interesting. So if you imagine that I have just, if you go back to the cartoon picture and imagine that I have just a single binary black hole in the cluster, if I throw a single star at that or a single black hole at that, it's going to undergo one of these crazy, chaotic resonant encounters that I was talking about. These are very difficult to predict, so at least what most groups do, ourselves included, is we directly integrate them using a small few-body integrator. But the cumulative effect of many of these encounters is going to be that, on average, when you throw a binary into one of these encounters, it's going to leave the encounter with a slightly smaller semi-major axis than it left in with. If you see this right now, I mean, you can see that in this encounter, the red and the blue stars actually exchanged, but the binary that was ejected clearly left with a you know, a faster orbital period and a shorter orbital separation than it came in with. Colloquially, we call this Hege's Law. It's this, just this idea that if you have binaries in a dense stellar environment that are, on average, moving faster than the typical velocity of a black hole or another star in the cluster, then on average, these encounters are going to continue to shrink the binary. And so if you imagine that I just have some single binary in the center of a cluster getting constantly buffeted by other black holes and stars, what's going to happen is that every time one of these encounters occurs, it's going to characteristically shrink the binary. Now that is going to lead, give a recoil to the system, which is going to shoot the binary up into the halo of the cluster. But then once it's out in the halo, dynamical friction, this tendency towards mass aggregation, takes effect again. It slowly pulls the binary back into the core, where there's a large number of other black holes for it to encounter, and the process begins again. But suddenly I have a much tighter, more energetic binary than I had before. So this process happens again and again and again, and each one of these encounters characteristically shrinks the binary and increases what's called the hardening. It basically increases the orbital speed until eventually one of these encounters is sufficiently energetic to completely eject it from the cluster. Now, right here I've just shown three of these different interactions, but you can imagine what's really controlling this is the escape speed of the cluster, right? If I have a more massive cluster, then I'm going to need more of these encounters in order to actually kick one of these binaries out. And this is, I think, one of the most interesting things about this entire formation channel. It's that despite the crazy chaotic nature of these encounters, and despite having to integrate a lot of this stuff in a very complicated, very chaotic fashion, it's actually the escape speed of the cluster that determines the semi-major axis and therefore the in-spiral times of the ejected binaries. So unlike the field where you have to either, you know, start off with contact binaries or you have to have a common envelope phase, our separation and therefore our in-spiral times are uniquely determined basically by the escape speed and the potential of the cluster itself. So despite all that crazy, crazy dynamics that goes into it, it's a very well understood statistical process. And if you look at this, you can actually just show directly that as I dial up the mass of one of these clusters, as I consider more and more massive clusters, the semi-major axes of the binaries that it kicks out are going to, you know, obviously shrink, and the in-spiral times are going to shrink as well. So this is just from some models that we generated at Northwestern, and right on the right here, you're actually looking at just the mass function of, say, globule clusters, these more massive old clusters. And as I look at more and more massive systems, the semi-major axes of the ejected binaries characteristically shrinks, and the in-spiral times go, you can usually see there's a nice line at 12 gig years here, but it's not showing up there. Whatever. But what's nice is that as you increase the mass and look towards more and more massive clusters, either the most massive globular clusters or galactic nuclei, you start to see that, at least for some of these clusters, you're injecting more than 50% of the binaries that you eject are going to merge within a Hubble time. Oh, yeah. So this actually depends specifically on the mass. So. So this actually is taken from a full simulation with a single stellar evolution code. So it's actually equivalent to the latest Star Trek results for single stars. So we actually have a black hole mass spectrum that runs from, depending on the metallicity, about 80 solar masses to 10 solar masses.
So this is integrated over all
the neurons? Yeah. So this is taken over everything. But the nice thing is if we actually control for the different masses and we just try to come up with some scaling relationship between the mass of a cluster and its radius, so essentially a proxy for its escape speed, and the mass of the binary over its semi-major axis, there's actually a really, really nice tight fit that we can put up there, which means we can actually just write down a probability distribution for just about any cluster of the eccentricity and semi-major axis of any system that gets kicked out. This holds for it holds for large enough open clusters, it holds for globulars, it holds for galactic nuclei that don't have a massive black hole in the center. And it's really nice that we can just write down simple, analytically tractable probability distributions to describe this otherwise incredibly complicated behavior. So what I'm going to go through now is just I'm going to try to talk about some of the rates and the masses that you would expect either from globular clusters or galactic nuclei. So just looking at globular clusters, going through the stuff that we've done at Northwestern, if you consider metallicity similar to what we see for globule clusters in the Milky Way, so generally about a quarter solar metallicity down to about a hundredth solar metallicity, when you see this nice, as a function of redshift, total mass, you see this nice progression from the most massive black holes that segregate fastest and get kicked out early and then merge very early. And as the clusters process through those most massive binaries, it slowly goes down to less and less massive binaries, to where in the local universe you get a nice distribution of sources from about 30 solar masses up to about total masses of 60. Which mostly actually explains, so GW150914 here is actually pretty reasonably in what you might expect for the masses from that. Oddly enough, LVT151012 is actually much better, right in the peak of those mass distributions, so I'm also inclined to believe that it's real, like Duncan is, just because, well, it comes right out of our stuff. Yeah. And so, in addition to the masses, of course, you can also talk about what the rates are going to be. Yeah, sure.
So on the left is the sun.
Oops, I can't go back. Silly little computer. There we go. So part of the problem here is that we're only looking at low metallicity globular clusters, and because we're generally considering the very massive ones, they're still actually retained most of their 5 to 10 solar mass black holes. So in these models, they're still stuck in the clusters. They haven't been ejected, and they're probably not going to merge in at least one Hubble time, according to our models. Now, that's true for globulars. For open clusters, where you have much higher metallicities, even supersolar metallicities, it's actually possible to get masses much lower than this. But, it depends on the mass, but it's usually around 40 to 80 kilometers a second, give or take. Yeah. So, if they're black hole kicks, actually, I'm going to talk about that in a second. If they're black hole kicks, globulars pretty much disappear as a reasonable source. They don't disappear, but they go down significantly, though with roughly the same rate as the field goes down. So, at least for the classical evolutionary scenario, yeah. Assuming, of course, you believe anything about anything we think we know about supernova kicks, which. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. The pulsar timing of the neutron stars observed in M15 tell you that there's less than 1,000 solar masses in any concentrated core within the region where the neutron stars are segregated. So you can't afford more than 30 of your 30 solar mass black holes. And that's one of the classic high mass.
Yeah. Well, so there's two slight caveats to that. One is that, at least in our models, you actually don't get, as long as you still retain some of the black holes, you actually haven't hit what the observers would call core collapse. So in order for core collapse, as an observer would call it, to occur, you actually need to kick out most of the black holes so that luminous objects can actually rush into the center and you would actually see, you know, that nice core collapsed profile. The other thing is that because of the way these things process through their black holes, they go from more massive to least massive. All the 30 solar mass black holes are going to be completely kicked out within the first gig year, give or take. No. So I'm not that familiar with N15. My guess would be if it's what the observers call core collapse, the story that we've always told ourselves is that actually means it's probably kicked out most of its black holes by the present day. Whether or not you're going to retain a large number towards to today is really a function of just how massive the thing is. I mean, 47 Tuck is actually really good for this, and there are now observations of at least black hole candidates inside 47 Tuck. So, I mean, we do at least think that some of these clusters have at least one or two black holes in them, and that's just the ones we can see in quiescence right now. Realistically, what we want is a very massive cluster. So we want something that really ends its life, or is in the present day about 3 times 10 to the 5 to at least to around 6 times 10 to the 5 solar masses, which is definitely on the high mass end of globular clusters. Well, it's I mean, it really just depends on whether you're talking about the observer central density, where you can sort of see the cusp forming in there, or if you actually have, say, possibly a non-luminous central density. So that's, I mean, let me phrase that a bit better. Yeah, so the central density is key in order to get a large enough number of interactions, but really what you want is a high central relaxation time, because that's going to let you process through these black holes much faster and kick out a lot more of them. So if I imagine a cluster that's a lot more dispersed, like so let's say a million stars but 7 parsecs, then I'm going to kick out a lot lower number of black holes, but I'm still going to be processing through these massive 30, 60 solar mass black holes up to the present day. So it really just depends on where I want to set mass and radius in order to adjust the relaxation time, because the relaxation time basically controls all of the dynamics. Yeah. We try to stay as far away from Omega Sin as possible, because as far as we can tell, it doesn't really behave anything like any of the other globular clusters. As for 47 Tuck, yeah, I mean, this is one of the things we usually do. We, like, make nice... Yeah. Yeah, and it's usually whatever are the most massive black holes left in the cluster that are really driving that central collapse. So if I have a bunch of 30 solar mass ones left, right in the core, and then a bunch of 15 solar mass ones, they're going to be not out in the halo, but still sort of around the central region, just because they can't get in where the 30 solar mass ones are still controlling the dynamics. Sorry. Cut off of what? So that gets a little interesting, actually. And I'm going to get to that for galactic nuclei in a very interesting example in a minute. So for the high metallicity clusters, which we just call about a quarter solar metallicity, you actually see this nice almost stratification right around here at 60 solar masses in terms of total mass, just because at least with our wind prescription, if you set everything to a quarter solar metallicity, then you just end up with this huge population of 30 solar mass black holes. So wherever the most massive black holes are in your cluster, if you have like just some large population there, you'll correspondingly end up with just this almost stratification right here in the mass distribution of black hole binaries. But so that's not all that interesting for globulars. But if I decide to look at stuff that's even larger, stuff that's like galactic nuclei. So nuclear star clusters. One way to think about them, although this always drives a couple of people I work with nuts, is they're basically just bigger honking globular clusters. So, but with a couple of key distinctions. So nuclear star clusters are extremely massive. They're about 10 to the 7 or 10 to the 8 stars. And they're also very compact. Usually they have roughly the same radii, give or take, as globular clusters. So this is a mass along here. And this line here actually just shows the same effective radius. And so nuclear star clusters generally live way up here, right, at significantly higher masses than the globular cluster population that we would talk about. For reference, Omega Sin is right here. Like I said, Omega Sin is a little bit bigger than most of the than all the other globular clusters we know. But even then, these nuclear star clusters are really about the biggest dense star clusters in town as far as this goes. And so there's.
Would you have any interesting binary black holes in arches today?
I'm embarrassed to say I don't know enough about arches to answer that question. But. Oh, it's 3 megayears?
Well, it was massive. I thought it was
massive.
Oh yeah, then you would never, I mean, even if you could form black holes at that point, that's way below the mass segregation timescale, so you wouldn't have a chance to actually bring anything in and start at least interesting dynamics. The two things about nuclear star clusters, though, that are distinct from globular clusters is, one, they seem to have continuous star formation. So they're somehow or another still bringing in gas and creating new stars throughout their lifetime. And the other thing is that some of them, at any rate, have a central massive black hole sitting there in the middle that can really, really change the dynamics in interesting fashions. And so I'm going to first start off just by talking about nuclear star clusters that don't have a central massive black hole. So this is from a recent paper that Fabio Antonini put out on the archive a couple of months ago. And it actually shows one of the things that it shows that's very interesting is how looking at clusters with substantially larger escape speeds actually changes the retention of black holes both before and after they could form binaries. So in the first case, you would have obviously these black hole natal kicks. And so what they're showing, what he's showing here is actually the escape speed of globular clusters in the Milky Way next to the escape speed of some of the observed nuclear star clusters. And what's neat about this is, obviously, as you consider deeper potential wells, you're going to have a higher escape speed. And so if you assume the most pessimistic scenarios where you assume black holes get full neutron star natal kicks, most nuclear star clusters would actually retain the majority of the black holes that they form. Unlike, say, globular clusters, where if you assume this solid peak here, which is full neutron star natal kicks, then most of the black holes would actually get ejected from globular clusters. There would basically be no black holes left after, say, about 20, 30 megayears. What's really interesting about this, though, is that because the escape speed is so high, that process I described before, where you basically have a series of strong encounters, and eventually one of those strong encounters kicks the black hole out of the cluster, most of the time, those encounters are not actually energetic enough to kick the black hole out of the cluster. So for a nuclear star cluster, you'll actually see a significant number of mergers occurring in the cluster as opposed to getting kicked out and occurring in the field. And even then, so once you have two black holes that are merging in a cluster, you're going to get, obviously, radiation recoil. You're going to get this, you know, relativistic effect. And even then, some of the tail of those distributions are going to be low enough that you would actually be able to retain those in a nuclear star cluster. So unlike a globular, where pretty much you form a binary, you buffet it around, and you throw it out, a nuclear star cluster can actually retain some of these binaries for a significant amount of through merger and even actually post-merger.
So why are we disrupting the binaries themselves?
Sorry, what? This is actually considering just singles. So for this, they were actually considering essentially a nuclear star cluster that was a giant globular cluster. And you bring the binaries into the center and then dynamically form them in the same fashion. So they're not primordial binaries. They're actually single black holes that then get dynamically formed later on. And the really cool thing about this is that, remember those stratifications I was showing before where you see just a large pileup at 30 solar masses? If you look at the same metallicity for these models, you actually see the same thing at 60 solar masses, and then another one at 90 and another one at 120. And that's actually because of these repeated in-cluster mergers. You know, you're going to have two 30 solar mass black holes merge. They're going to leave behind a 60 solar mass remnant. And then that's not going to get ejected from the cluster. So it's still going to hang out in the cluster and eventually find another massive black hole, either another 30 solar mass black hole or a 60 solar mass black hole, and then possibly merge again. And what that means,
do these predictions depend on your assumed initial population of binaries? If you have no initial binaries, do you form them by three-body interaction? So the rates are actually relatively independent of what you start with?
Yeah, so for globulars, the rates are almost completely independent of initial binary fraction. Usually, just about everything that we shoot out of a cluster was dynamically formed. For nuclear star clusters, it gets a little trickier because if you have a binary that's pre-existing and then it gets locked into orbit around the central massive black hole, that can be interesting in a different fashion, which I'll mention briefly in a second. But yeah, as far as we can tell, most of our results are insensitive to the initial binary fraction. It's just pure dynamics, which is part of the reason it's nice, actually, because the dynamics basically washes out any of our uncertainty in the initial conditions, and then it's just, you know, complicated but tractable Newtonian dynamics. So this is a more semi-analytic approach that Fabio developed a few months ago. There's no hydro. There's actually not any explicit dynamics in this. This is using. I can explain it more later on if people are interested. But it's a semi-analytic approach that combines black holes in a sort of statistical fashion consistent with what we've seen in models and then ejects them over time. But no, there's no Hydra, unfortunately. There is continuous star formation in this, but yeah. And so, you know, this would normally be where the highest mass black holes would be in this, but up here you've got multiple merging black holes that are repeatedly merging in the cluster and not necessarily getting ejected. And one thing that I don't think has been mentioned that would be very interesting from this is that we know, at least from GW150914 and most of relativity, right, that if you have even two non-spinning black holes merge, you're going to get a remnant mass of 0.7, right? That's pretty well understood. Which means that any of these suckers, when they form a secondary binary, at least one of them is going to have a spin going into it of 0.7. So I think this is something that Chris Pankow at Northwestern was really interested in. But you might have the possibility of creating a second population with these nice stratifications, both in mass and spin space, which would be a really interesting thing to be able to measure. So unfortunately, the rates for this are a little bit lower than what we see for globular clusters. So the rates for globules we predict to be about 5 per gigaparsec cube per year. For nuclear star clusters, it's about 1.5. So still good, not quite as good. Yeah? Mm-hmm. So there have been several papers on that. I'm embarrassed to say I haven't read them as thoroughly as I should have. So the rates for that the AGN papers I've read predict are somewhat lower. They're usually about 0.1 per gigaparsec cube per year. Truth be told, I don't really know how it would affect this particular semi-analytic model. I'd have to think about that a bit more. The general idea is, you know, if you have some AGN gas, that the drag is actually going to accrete onto the black hole binary and lead it to merger much faster. That's my simplistic understanding of it. But yeah, but and so if I go back to nuclear star clusters, but then put a central massive black hole in the center, though, then I do get. I'll speed through this real quick. Then I do get a few additional possibilities that are kind of interesting. One is that you might actually have single capture. So you end up with some Bacall-Wolf cusp essentially right around the central massive black hole. You have a huge velocity dispersion, and it is actually possible to have two single black holes come close enough together that they will emit such a large burst of gravitational radiation that they'll immediately gravitationally capture each other and then merge in a highly eccentric orbit. Unfortunately, what Tsang showed in 2013 was that the rates for that are not very encouraging. So it hasn't been something that we've looked at a lot more recently. But the papers that are more interesting there were O'Leary in 2009 and I think Tsang in 2013. The second one was actually just the AGN disk-induced in spiral, which predicted a slightly better rate of about 0.1 per gigaparsec cubed per year, which translates to a optimistic LIGO detection rate of about 20 per year. So something that's definitely worth understanding better. And then finally, there's this idea that if you have a central massive black hole and you have a binary going in orbit around it, that's essentially a three-body system. So you could actually set up a sort of a Lydov-Kozai-induced merger. And so you would actually have this case where the inclination eccentricity of the binary's orbit around the central massive black hole would oscillate back and forth and eventually drive the binary up to a very high eccentricity, where it actually starts emitting gravitational waves at an E of like 0.999. The rates for that, so the one that just recently got published was 100 per gigaparsec cube per year with some, shall we say, very optimistic assumptions in there. So I would consider that and in fact, Van Lanningham does specifically point out that this is by far the biggest upper limit they can come up with for this. But again, very, very interesting. And unlike some of the other mechanisms presented here, the Kozai-induced mergers, a lot of those will actually hit the LIGO band with significant eccentricity. So they would actually be something we could discriminate between almost all field formation channels. So looking at different ways to try to isolate, you know, the field versus clusters, with these new wind prescriptions and these massive black holes, the masses and the mass ratios, it turns out, tend to come out about equal. There's virtually no difference between the two. The eccentricity, though, and the spins, I think, are where we're going to be able to really start pulling apart these two populations. Even if it's just at sort of the periphery, it'll be really where we can start to get a handle on how to discriminate between these two populations. So, that's stupid. Yeah, I'm out of time, so I'm just going to go ahead and stop. One the last thing I wanted to show real quick was this one plot of the eccentricity distribution that you would expect for things that are driven to merger by Lyapunov-Kozai oscillations. And at least 20% of these systems are going to have eccentricities above about 0.1, give or take. And there's also going to be a large pileup, at least if you use a full in-body code to do this, of systems with eccentricities of about 0.999. So, you know, if you hear any weird bursting thumps in LIGO, that's probably what it is. Well, that's definitely not true. But that would be an interesting thing to check for. All right, well, yeah, I'm out of time, so I'm just happy to answer questions, and thank you. So it doesn't. So an IMBH won't pump up the velocity dispersion enough to get single capture, and you don't really develop a cusp just because it's not big enough. What I think we've seen is that, I'm trying to remember, this was Morgan McLeod that looked at this. I think it suppresses the merger rate actually, because then usually what'll happen is you'll have the IMBH, and it will usually develop just one or two very close stellar companions along the way. And then that actually inhibits the formation of just other binaries coming in and forming three-body binaries. So usually when there's an IMBH in the center, it sort of runs the table, give or take, in a manner of speaking.
Can you show one of the diagrams where you show the mass of the vertical axis?
Sure.
So your mass of that comes from the recipes that this fire and the plasticity
Yeah. It's not, and it's.
It would be very easy to get there. I think it's one. It's becoming harder and harder for LIGO to find more and more messy things. But if we stop finding any black holes above that mass, it's
Would it be possible to maybe see the other side of the gap too? I can't remember where exactly the parent stability gap is.
It's going to be hard there.
Yeah.
Might be filling it up with bigger mergers. The other thing is that we've been working with Lydia Mando to do some proper estimates on this chemical McGinnis evolution channel, and there you have, with some assumptions, you might have black hole mergers above this plane stability gap. So this would be above 130 solar masses per black hole. And it would seem that advanced LIGO could detect these things if they merge close enough.
That's 130 for each component or total mass?
Yes.
Okay, that's large. We do. It's an analytic prescription from the literature. I'd have to look it up to remember exactly what it is. So the approach that we use is this Monte Carlo approach. It's not a direct in-body integration. And basically, we can treat pairwise interactions between stars on a relaxation timescale. And tidal capture is one of the things that we do.
How do you treat them? You just assume that some of them dissipate.
I don't entirely remember the details, to be honest. For globulars, yeah. For open clusters, that question becomes a lot more, I didn't want to say open, but open. So if you have a lot of binaries from primordial binaries, two things will happen. One, you'll enter this phase that's almost called a binary burning phase. So in order to start forming dynamically three-body binaries, you have to reach this core collapse phase. And if you have already a bunch of binaries that exist, the binding energy from those in three-body encounters actually sort of arrests the continued collapse of the cluster. So you'd have to get rid of some of those to begin with. The other interesting thing would be if you have a bunch of binary binaries, a lot of times those encounters pretty efficiently produce triple systems, which unfortunately we don't keep in our code at the moment. We're working on that right now. But. So our code and most of the in-body codes, actually, in fact, I think all of them are coupled to, at this point, BSE. So continuously, we track changes in mass, changes in radius, and how that updates both the collision probabilities of things and the in-body dynamics itself, because obviously losing some mass is going to change how you're integrating that. So for the models that we considered, and I think the models that just about everybody else has considered, you don't have some initial fixed population, you're continuously evolving some large chunk of the IMF that you've put into a cluster early on.
Yeah, I guess the question really is there's, I presume, still significant uncertainties in how that is all modeled. So how does that come into So how does that come into the prediction?
So we haven't really we haven't really looked at how uncertainties in single stellar evolution would affect this. I know from experience that if you introduce a bug in the wind prescription, you end up with a radically different black hole mass, which is not a great way of doing science, but it is illustrative for this purpose. The best I've been able to do right now is to say that our single stellar evolution is consistent and identical to the single stellar evolution for black hole masses that at least was present in Star Trek a couple years ago. So that was really what we've done for the most recent models, was try to get something we could compare as well as possible to field predictions. As for binaries, it really just depends how much you want to trust BSE. Fortunately, because almost all of our binaries are actually dynamically formed, it's pretty much insensitive to any of the physics of binary stellar evolution that you put in there. So even if you pick wildly insane values for alpha, lambda, common envelope, or anything else, you pretty much end up with the same black hole merger rate and black hole mass spectrum at the end. But again, if you want to start doing, so I'm just going to throw my last slide up there because it's something that I think is actually a very interesting question that Selma actually brought up. It's where exactly is the dividing line between field and clusters? I know. Especially if you assume that most massive stars, or even a lot of massive stars, are formed in clusters, then is it possible you'll have this scenario where you have some initial condition that is partially thrashed by dynamics before the cluster dissolves, but not so much as to completely erase those initial conditions? I don't think anybody's looked at that, to my knowledge, particularly well at all. At least the in-body dynamics, when we've tried to go down that low, we're still doing this very, very hand-wavy BSE. I don't know as much about how people have tried to incorporate dynamics into MESA or good stellar modeling, but yeah.
So I just wanted to ask briefly about rates. Mm-hmm. So for this, so you have some prediction of rates, and it sounds like it's probably fairly robust, just because you've been arguing it doesn't depend too much on initial conditions, or
well. So the robust part of it is the dynamics. That part, I mean, we can solve solve Newton's equation, hopefully. The problem comes in when you start trying to put together, in a reasonable sense, a population of this. So essentially, when I start trying to do the population of clusters, either globular or galactic nuclei, or especially open clusters, because then you have to couple that to a star formation history and an initial cluster formation history. And that's where really the large uncertainties in this start to come in. So for the rates that we published, we just looked at the current observed mass distribution of globular clusters today, isn't it? And just as said, well, we know this is a super restrictive subset of the total population, but at least it's something we understand well and can constrain really well. And even then, the uncertainties in the spatial density of globular clusters, basically gave us an order of magnitude variation in the rate estimates.
So basically, I mean, so LIGO has two orders of magnitude in uncertainty, but no matter where we end up on that, there won't be any tension.
Well, actually, the lowest rates have already, well, then the problem comes in that, I mean, I seriously doubt, I don't think anybody thinks that clusters are the only thing creating black hole binaries. So then it's a question of how much are you contributing from the field, how much are you contributing from clusters, how much are you contributing from everything else. If you want to do it for all from clusters, correct me if I'm wrong, the new lower bound is 9 mergers per gigaparsec cube per year? Yeah. So the number we predicted was 5. So if it was all from clusters, we'd already be excluded. Except for our most, our optimistic estimates were about 20 per gigaparsec cube per year. But even that's kind of on the low end, I think, of the predictions from LIGO at this point. So, but that's almost more fun, right? It's nice to have a nice combination of everything. Yeah. Well, so the one thing I'm not quite sure about is I think figuring out where disrupting globular clusters and disrupting open clusters, what they've left, sort of the binaries they've left behind, I'm not sure if that's been answered. It's certainly not been answered looking at like a distribution of open cluster masses. So the best I know right now is this paper by Ziosi et al, where they found actually a pretty optimistic, or a pretty good rate for disrupting open clusters. But they only considered a single mass of clusters instead of actually trying to fit it to some cluster initial mass function. And that can actually really radically change the results. That's part of the reason we started seeing such higher merger rates than anybody else had, was just because we were looking at a full mass spectrum of clusters as opposed to just a single globular cluster mass. So I think this number could go up or down pretty significantly. The only problem with open clusters is because they're so tiny, their escape speeds are also tiny. So for instance, for our most massive clusters, you'll see about 60 to 70% of the binaries will merge in a Hubble time. For these 5,000 star clusters, they were finding that 0.3% of binaries will merge in a Hubble time.
Okay.
For the nucleus star cluster case, can I just think of the number of mergers of scaling with the total black holes formed by my EMF? I mean, so for instance, you know, we have a lot of growing evidence that nuclear star clusters have top heavy IMFs, which could produce 10 times as many black holes, for instance. So I'm just wondering, if that's true, does your one that Fred predicts, 1.5, become 15? Or
I'm not sure if it scales linearly. I'm sorry, I don't have a better answer than that.
So have you looked at the distribution of the projected separation of the neutron star merger that you get from your cluster simulation?
The neutron star, unfortunately, it's not great. So at least for these ones where you have a large black hole population, you're mostly, the black holes are going to be the ones in the center still controlling the dynamics. So you never really get to this point where you can have neutron stars falling into the center and then dynamically forming binaries. But this is somewhat at odds with what we see in clusters like 47 Tuck, where you have a large number of millisecond pulsars that we think were all spun up by accretion in some sort of dynamics-induced interaction. So we haven't looked at neutron stars. When we have, the LIGO rates are not very encouraging. They're lower than what you would expect from the field.
What I'm getting at is, with the spirit of finding ways to distinguish the different channels, have you looked, for example, okay, maybe for the black hole mergers, given your delay times and your expected escape velocities, which are connected to your separation, so you should get a very clear answer, what kind of separation you will expect between the host galaxy and the location where the merger will occur?
Oh, you mean what speed are they getting kicked out with?
Well, 50 kilometers per second, typical cluster escape velocity. You need that, probably higher. So if the delay time is 1 giga year, you expect more than 100,000 light years separation between.
Remember, most globulars are in the payload of the galaxy. 50 kilometers a second is nothing. So they don't actually go any further. It's like an M87, right? The escape velocity. Mm-hmm.
But my understanding was that you need most of the one you see, I get ejected from the cluster. That was one of your first slides.
That's for black holes, yeah.
Yeah, fine.
So you're imagining you'd kick out a binary neutron star, it would get some significant distance off, you know, off of the galaxy, and then you might see a GRB from that or something, or?
Right.
I don't know. I haven't looked at that. Okay. We don't really eject that many binary neutron stars. They're going to merge within a Hubble time, but that would be interesting.
Okay, last question. I wanted to ask again about the binary fraction. So did you say that you use a binary fraction of like 5%? So
yeah.
That's for the low mass stars, which dominate the dynamics, right?
Because we actually do that for just about everything, which I realize is.
So would you think results would change a lot if the high mass stars would have 100% binary fraction? That is what we're finding in R136 in the star cluster. With two epochs of observations, we find basically all of them to be in close binary, so close that you, for you, you might not even call them a binary because they're so close that they have, they're hard compared to the.
So Shirov Chatterjee did a study where he actually considered a different binary fraction for the massive stars, and it doesn't actually create a particularly large difference, because most of the time, at least for these massive clusters, it's entirely dynamics that's controlling it. The one thing that would be interesting would be if you have these things merge early on and leave behind very massive black holes, like say above what you would normally see just for single stars, then you might end up with some population of, I don't know, 100 or 120 solar mass black holes hanging out in the cluster. But to be honest, I don't think our binary stellar evolution treatment is quite precise enough to handle that.
Okay, so let's thank Carl again, and we will reconvene at 2 o'clock.